comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you happen to be all around this beautiful planet, thank you for being here. From continent to continent all around this planet, we are live in every time zone right now. And I appreciate you for being here wherever you happen to be. I'm here because you have a right to know. I'm here because you matter. We started something 3 months ago that has, up till now, been very successful. And I hope that this month it's going to be successful, and I think it's going to be. I have every reason to believe that it will be. And it is called the Alternative Universe Eye Conference. And when we say Alternative Universe, people, you know, they think of alternative in a very narrow band, but folks, you got to widen it out as wide as the horizon, because it is alternative in terms of the topics we talk about. That's what most people think about. But it's alternative in terms of just about everything associated with it, including the fact that it is 100% a live conference streamed directly to you. Now, there are conferences in a conference hall somewhere where they turn on cameras and they stream to you what's going on in that conference hall. And you get to sit over on the sideline and just be a spectator. Well, that is one of the alternative things about this. This is designed 100% to come to you. So the speakers are speaking to you. It's as if they were in your living room giving you a private presentation. And then whenever it's over, whenever the presentation is over, there's a question and answer time where you can ask your questions. It's live. It's not pre-recorded. And it's really, really, really dynamic. Very interesting information and very compelling information. It's alternative in the way that we charge for it as well. Those other conferences that I talked about, and I'm not critical of them, but you know, they charge like 80, 90, 100 bucks for you to sit on the sideline and watch what they're doing in the conference hall. This is different. We decided right at the beginning of this to make this affordable for just about anybody. Now, we can't do it for free. It's just not possible. But it's only 10 bucks. It's not 80, 90, 100. It's $10. But the quality of what you're going to get, well, it's worth, the ticket is worth no less than $100. But it only costs you $10. That's all great news, isn't it? And it's going to happen this Saturday, this coming Saturday. That's great news too, isn't it? And you haven't bought your ticket yet, and that's not good news, because you don't have but about 48 hours. That's it, about 48 hours, and ticket sales close. Go to my website, scroll down, click where it says Alternative Universe Eye Conference, and get your ticket. Right now, we'll be back. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. Now, Stanton Friedman really needs no introduction, except for those of you who are brand new to our genre. And here's the introduction I'm going to give you. When you think of Stanton Friedman, think of everything that you could possibly want to know about UFOs, all right? And then once you've thought of all the possibilities of everything you want to know about UFOs, go look and try to find some books about it. Now, when you do, you're going to see it's loaded up with books by Stanton Friedman, okay? He is a nuclear physicist. He is a lecturer. He is an author. And he is my guest this evening. Stanton Friedman, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Delighted to be on again.
Now, it's been a while, Stanton, since I have used this particular telephone system that we're on. So if you hear an echo back in your earpiece, you let me know and I'll try to make adjustments, okay? Sometimes I can fix that and sometimes I can't.
Nobody's perfect.
Well, no, and especially not me. But Stanton, usually when you're here, we talk about books that you've written, usually a new book you've got out, and we certainly will be talking about some stuff that's in your books tonight. But we've got something new cooking on the stove right now. You've got two movie deals or something like that, right?
Yeah, options have been taken. I guess that's the Hollywood to use. First, on my book, Top Secret Magic, about the Majestic 12 documents, Stellar Productions, Bryce Zabel, who did the series back a number of years ago, Dark Skies, has optioned my book. Roswell, and he's optioned our life stories and memoirs and all that sort of junk. And the screenplay's been written. I'm anxious to see it. I haven't seen it yet. It's called Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C, because the security markings on the Majestic 12 documents are Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C. And the idea is to make a dynamic, not a documentary, but a powerful motion picture, sort of like Go All the President's Men and maybe a little JFK thrown in. And Richard Dreyfuss will play me, I keep saying.
You know, that would be a good choice, actually.
Well, he was born in 1947, so he's younger than I am. But, and the point is, you know, I hate to admit it with my name on five books, but more people watch movies than read books, Kevin. Do you believe that?
Yeah,
hard
I do.
To imagine, but it's true.
The
second project, my book with Kathleen Martin captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience, has also been optioned. That was just a couple months ago. Bryce Zabel again, and one of his co-directors, producers, whatever, is Donnie Most. Remember Donnie from Happy Days?
Yeah.
And now if we can get them both to gang up and get Ron Howard involved, boy.
That would be good.
Dreaming, but they're still friends, incidentally. So it's a happy thought that maybe before I reel off this world of ours, I could have two movies out there. Now, you know, I realize that a movie does not have to stick to the details of the books at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the way life is. So I expect there to be changes. But if they catch the essence of it, then I would be very happy because these are two very important stories. On the one hand, the Majestic 12 stuff. You can't believe how much junk I've read about Majestic 12 documents. People coming up with all kinds of reasons why they must be fraudulent. they don't do any research, you see, but they do a lot of proclamation. And I've been to 20 archives, and I love going to archives. I hate to admit that publicly because nobody will pay you for doing it. But these are the most important classified documents ever leaked to the public as far as I'm concerned. And yes, I am perfectly aware that there's over 100 phony MJ-12 documents. I'm interested in the three genuine ones. Who cares mm-hmm. about the phony ones?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, it's really strange the way this thing works. Like you said, you know, all these people become experts the instant they sit down at their keyboard and go online. That
yep.
That's what makes them the expert. They have a keyboard. And, you know, I heard within this last week that international police don't exist, and I never was a police chief.
Oh.
Yeah, an expert. An expert, keyboard expert. Now, Bryce Zabel has been a guest on this show. And I'll tell you something. I know you're familiar with it, but folks, do you remember the TV series Dark Skies? You remember that?
Yeah.
Stanton, I've heard over and over and over for years speculation about just how much truth was there in the X-Files that they were leaking out. Folks, if you thought X-Files had some stuff in it, you go watch the Dark Skies series.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, I was amazed when I sit down and watch the Dark Skies series at just how open and how close to the bullseye it was on so much of that stuff.
Yeah, and Bryce wrote a nice recommendation it's on the back cover of Top Secret Magic,
mm-hmm.
Because he's done his homework, and that's a rarity. He also co-authored a book with Richard Dolan called After Disclosure,
mm-hmm.
About what happens, you know, when disclosure comes and so forth. So he's taken an active part in finding out what's going on, really getting his facts in place. And that's comforting. I understand that often movies are made without people doing that, you know.
Yeah.
Don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up.
Well, let me ask you this now. And first, let me say congratulations on these two movie options, because both of the books that have been optioned would make fantastic movies. And congratulations. You deserve it.
Thank you. I hope they will.
All right, now let me ask you this, because there are millions of experts at keyboards all over the world. Are you still a nuclear physicist?
Well, that depends on how you look at it. Nobody's paying me to be one, but I certainly am writing my MUFON paper, for example, for the August Symposium of MUFON, and I do talk about things nuclear in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel I have to keep up with what's going on. And I feel that I bring to bear activities in the nuclear world, which most people have never had the opportunity to do. And that includes one of the key features of the question of, can flying saucers be real? You can't get here from there. Well, I worked on fission nuclear rockets. I worked on fusion nuclear rockets. I keep up with what's going on in that area, and not much because there's not a lot of money being spent, but it's one of the areas in which I get most upset by the SETI people. They think that all there is chemical rockets, for goodness sakes. And that's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And the point here is that every advanced civilization is going to wonder, how does it star produce all that energy? And we wondered that, and if you'd gone back 110 years or so, you'd have heard that it was burning gas. What else could it be? And then finally, about 1938, it came up with the idea that nuclear fusion, my goodness. Wouldn't even know about the neutron until 1932. So fusion became the answer to the big question, where's the energy coming from? And naturally, being Earthlings the way we are, we first put out a fission weapon because it's easier, frankly. And then in 1952, we exploded our first fusion device. And some people will say, well, what do you mean exploded? Come on, there's a difference between propulsion and explosion, right? Well, not exactly. First atomic bomb was July 16th, 1945. It was just out at that site, incidentally, the Trinity site in New Mexico. But the first fusion device went off 7 years later. And the reason I bring it up is because I find people are not well aware of what difference it makes if you go from chemicals, say TNT, to fission or fusion, to nuclear processes. And there's an enormous difference. And even though we exploded our first fission device in 1945, July, we had nuclear rockets operating in the late 60s, and more important, nuclear submarines operating in the early 50s. And boy, from a vehicle that can run on the surface and go under the water for maybe a day, which is what submarines used to be, they can go around the whole world without coming to the surface. There's a big difference there, in other words.
Yes, sir.
And when it comes to propulsion system, I worked on fission rockets. And, boy, I'm still impressed by the fact that Los Alamos built one that was less than, you know, about 7.5 feet in diameter, operated a power level of 4,400 megawatts. And to give you a sense of perspective, that is twice the power of Hoover Dam. And less than 8 feet in diameter. That was fission.
And that was in the 1960s?
Yeah, late about 69. There were several different ones operated. I worked for Westinghouse. We operated one. Aerojet General operated one. And Los Alamos operated the biggest ones. But I was involved in a study of fusion power for rocketry, early 1960s. And you can see the progression. From chemical, a 10-ton blockbuster was big in World War II. 1945, 19,000 tons, the bombs dropped on Japan about that, of TNT equivalent. 52, 10 million tons. So that's one heck of a jump in a very short period of time. But that means that you could, if you wanted to spend the money, and it isn't cheap, you could build a fusion rocket that would kick particles out the back end that would have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million times.
So why aren't we
doing it? It's not imaginary. Why aren't we doing it? Because it costs a heck of a lot of money and we're not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you go back to the Navy again. They went from the submarine to a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, which will operate only for 18 years without refueling.
Not bad.
18 years!
Mm-hmm. Not bad.
That's a little different than using gasoline or diesel oil or whatever you burn in a regular conventional aircraft carrier. So what I'm saying is we're already at the point, and we didn't even know about the neutron until 1932, for goodness sakes. And so if anybody out there is a little bit ahead of us, maybe only 1,000 years,
mm-hmm.
Look back 1,000, look back 100, and see how much progress we can make in that period of time. And that's where people go astray, the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them. They don't know what we've done in the area of nuclear propulsion. Partly because it's not done in academia, it's done in industry.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, they don't want to know. They think we're stuck with where we are, and all we got to do is listen for signals. And now, I'd love to get a panel of psychiatrists and say, why in the world would aliens, who might be 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000 years ahead of us, send signals here when they don't know anybody here? and use technology that's appropriate for us. I mean, what good is sending a signal if the other guy can't receive it, interpret it, translate it, whatever you want to call it? Why would they use ancient technology for them? You know, nobody's answered that question to my satisfaction.
Yeah, anyway. We're not sending out smoke signals to anybody.
I don't think Columbus did even before he headed west.
Yeah.
You know, and so you have to say, what kind of reasoning are we doing here? It's good jobs for the SETI people, and they get a good press, and I certainly have no objection to using radio telescopes to find out what's going on in the universe. Any device that enables you to see stuff is good, you know. But that's different from saying you want to find aliens, but why don't we look at the evidence if the aliens have found us? They don't want to do that. That's no good, because then you wouldn't need SETI. You wouldn't need radio telescopes, would you? Mm.
Well, you know, one of the big waves making its way across the surface of the UFO ocean right now, and it's done it before. I mean, this is not the first time this has come through, but it's coming through again. And that is this wave that... all of the UFO stuff that we call UFOs, all of that is really just hoaxed by the U.S. military as a cover for their black projects. And this time, it's coming from some fairly well-known voices in the UFO community.
Well, formerly and it's in nonsense. The UFO community.
The what?
Yeah, I've read the former director of MUFON is saying that's the case, the biggest hoax there ever was, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
And I read what he said. I did a column. I do a monthly column for the MUFON Journal, Mutual UFO Network Journal. And I dealt with his conclusions back, I think it was 3 years ago now. They don't stand up.
No. They don't.
And I say that having talked to many of the key people involved with Roswell, for example. He doesn't believe that Roswell was alien. He gives the CIA credit for everything.
Well, I'll tell you what. He may give the CIA credit for us taking a break right here, but we have to. And I want to pick up right there when we come back, because, I mean, that's one of the most bizarre positions I've heard anybody take from inside the UFO community, but and it has nothing to do with whether I believe in UFOs or not. I don't believe in UFOs. I either know or I don't. All right, folks, we'll be back.
To the Kevin Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and this is Kevin Smith. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. Stanton, when we went away for break, we were talking about this notion that the U.S. government did it all. I know you don't buy that. I don't buy that. And
no.
You know, one of the easiest ways to prove that that doesn't work is just go back to, like, the 1700s, the 1600s, and all those paintings with flying saucers in them. That's before there was even a U.S. There was no United States then. So people have been seeing these, depicting them, and reporting them all the way back to the cavemen.
Well, maybe people don't realize that there's a book out by Dr. Jacques Vallée and Chris Albeck. It includes only sightings from before 1885. So you know it wasn't an earthbound object that was earth-originated object that was flying up there. They've got about 500 reports.
Mm-hmm.
500!
Yeah.
You know, so it's not new. And then you have the excellent book by Dr. Barry Downing, The Bible and Flying Saucers. Goes back to the Old and New Testaments, long before the CIA was around. You know, it's one of those things that you're trying to fit a round peg in a square hole and it doesn't fit.
Mm.
There's no question that the CIA keeps secrets, but what can we say about the NSA and the DIA and the ONI and all those guys? The NSA, it took 15 years to get it, but they finally released copies of 156 top secret Umbra UFO documents about UFOs. That's their terminology. That's what they call them. And the interesting thing is, of course, that you can read like one sentence per page. Everything else is whited out.
Yeah.
Now, the excuse is, oh, it's sources and methods information. How can that be 95% of what's in a document?
Yeah. Really?
Information doesn't count, but sources, that's what this is all about. It makes no sense, the CIA running the show thing.
Do you know when the first UFO report here in North America?
Was I what?
Do you know when was the first UFO report here in what is today the United States?
Well, the one that people give credit to, of course, is Kenneth Arnold's sighting on June 24th, 1947. But
no, it's in the 1700s.
There were sightings long before that.
The first UFO report happened in Massachusetts, and it's written by the British governor of Massachusetts before there was a United States.
Wow.
Yeah. I forget the exact year. It was 1700 something. What happened was some guys were fishing on the river, and they saw a thing in the air that kept going up and back and forth down the river, and then they suddenly were like 2 miles from where they were supposed to be. And they reported it to the governor, and the governor wrote this in his journal, and it still exists.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Learn something new every day. Good.
Yeah. So that's something, you know, from before there was even a United States. So these things have been around for a long time, and you've been studying them, you've been writing about them for a long time. Let me ask you your opinion. What do you think they are?
Well, it's not a question of they. My conclusion is that some UFOs are intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. I didn't say all UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
Just like not all isotopes are fissionable. Fortunately, some are.
Mm-hmm.
Not all people are 7 feet tall. The basketball coach says, I don't care about all, give me one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so the best cases I wind up labeling intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. No question. And again, I am not answering the question, what are UFOs? I'm answering the question, are any UFOs intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft? And I say very definitely yes. And, you know, you get the same stories all over the world. I've lectured in all 50 states and 10 Canadian provinces and 18 other countries, and everybody seeing the same kind of stuff, and very good response from all of those places. So the kicker here is that we've got a small group of nasty, noisy negativists who think that they don't need to do any homework. They know right from the start that there's anything but alien. ABA, that's their viewpoint. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. And if you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier, you know.
Mm-hmm. Attack the message.
They got a problem. I'll let a psychiatrist worry about what it is. The will not to believe is certainly deserving of a PhD thesis to go with the other 10 or 11 that have been done so far. But
But so you know, it's not really even at the level of believe anymore. There's just so much evidence, so much data, that at this point, you know, saying do you believe in UFOs is like saying do you believe in doorknobs. There's so much
data,
and they're just there. Now, you know, I don't know much else about them, but there they are.
They're made out of many different materials. That may be true for UFOs as well.
So, now I want to go back to the fission and fusion.
Yep.
Can we step back there for just a moment?
Sure.
Okay. I know the difference
between... Let me make clear that one of the reasons I was at the Trinity site where the first nuclear weapon was exploded just a few weeks ago, it's only open 2 days a year. The first Saturday in April and the first one in October, and I was there with a tour of people and stuff. But it was taking me back to my roots, because one of the reasons I went to the University of Chicago when I did back in the 50s was Enrico Fermi was there, and he and many of his colleagues put together the first nuclear chain reaction under the squash court at the University of Chicago. And those guys were involved with the development of nuclear weapons. But there were so many smart guys there. And when Fermi died, he died while I was there. If you could have heard the comments made by his colleagues, these guys were pretty sharp cookies too. But he was a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's one of the great ironies of the Second World War. The reason that Fermi, who was an Italian, and he did Nobel Prize-winning kind of work, he got a Nobel Prize in 1938, nuclear work that he did in Italy, but his wife was Jewish, and Benito Mussolini was starting to behave a bit like Hitler. So the Fermis went to Oslo to collect the Nobel Prize in 1938, and they went right on to the United States and never went back to Italy. So here we had, and this was true of a number of the scientists working on the program, they left Europe because of the discrimination, the hate, et cetera, et cetera. And so they turned around, and here they were in the United States instead of in Germany. Can you imagine what the world would have been like if Germany had built the first atomic bomb?
It would have been tough.
You know, entirely different place. So... physics and psychology and sociology all merge together. But fission is, there are hundreds of nuclear-powered ships.
Well, here's what I would like for you to do.
Give
us a thumbnail sketch for those who may not know the difference between fission and fusion. What is, just in a thumbnail sketch, what's the difference?
Okay, fission involves isotopes of uranium, which is the heaviest naturally occurring metal, highest atomic number, got loads of protons and neutrons. And it turns out that one isotope of uranium, U-235, absorbs neutrons much more readily and fissions, splits, gives up, it becomes two atoms where there was one, but it gives up a little mass, and that mass gets converted into energy, that old E equals MC squared business. So that's fission. Uranium, plutonium, thorium, high atomic number elements. Now, at the opposite end, completely at the opposite end, fusion involves putting together two very light isotopes, atoms, whatever you want to call them, nuclei. Hydrogen's the lightest. Next is helium. If you react the right isotopes of hydrogen and helium, you combine two small things into a larger one, and again, for some crazy reason, because God made the world that way, I guess, you get some mass converted to energy. Now, the problem is that these are charged particles, and they don't like each other. Opposites react against each other. So the problem is, how do you keep this stuff together long enough for fusion to happen? And the easiest way to do it is to start with an atomic bomb. That heats everything up, gets it going real fast, overcomes the repulsion. Now the isotopes like each other briefly, because they got so much energy they can't help it, and you get a fusion explosion. So typically you start with fission, then you go to fusion. And it may surprise people to know that one of the devices that oil companies use, they put down a little small fusioning device, not a bomb. It's a little electric accelerator kind of thing. And you produce neutrons. And the neutrons interact with the oil around you, of course. And that gives you a, when you measure what comes out, it gives you a handle on how much oil there is there. So that's a peacetime little fusion device, and you can buy them if you want to. So they're two very different things. And again, if you go back to the energy release, rough number, 10-ton chemical bomb, 19,000 tons fission bomb, 10 million tons of TNT, this is equivalent. That's a fusion bomb. The Russians built one that was, hate to admit it, but 57 million tons of TNT energy release in one bomb. And you put that in the middle of New Jersey, and you'd start fires from New York to Philadelphia. That's really rather impressive. Depressive, depending on how you look at it.
Very depressive,
So fission and fusion, two different things. And the kicker is, uranium isn't that common. And the Earth happens to be a dense planet, so we probably have a little more uranium than most other planets do. But hydrogen and helium, the stuff you use for the fusion device, you find all over the place out there. The two lightest and most abundant substances in the universe. So uranium is heavy, hydrogen is light, and it's everywhere. So rather different systems. It's easy to do the fission, because of the chain reaction and the neutrons. But boy, fusion will give you one heck of a bigger bomb.
Well, you mentioned earlier sometimes people don't know the difference between an explosion and propulsion. You know, an explosion is just real fast propulsion, isn't it?
Well, there's another difference. In the fusion systems, for example, the reactions you want to use are the ones that produce charged particles.
Okay, I have to ask you to hang on to that. We have a break coming up, but when we come back, I want to hear the difference between propulsion and explosion. Ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, you need to get your tickets to the Alternative Universe, iConference. Go to my website, scroll down, click the link. All right, we shall return. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Stanton Friedman. Stanton, when we went away for break, you were explaining the difference between explosion and propulsion.
Yeah, and it's a very important distinction. Let's start with fission. The atomic bomb is a fission device, and you.
Well, I don't know what has happened, but suddenly you started to break up, and it's not your phone. I don't know what happened. So you started to tell us what happens with fission.
Yeah, with fission, you can do several different things. In nuclear power reactors, and there are over 400 of them in the world, you have a nuclear chain reaction cruising along. Every fission produces 2.5 neutrons, and one of those produces another fission. And these generate energy, quite a bit of energy per pound. If you pump water past the system, you can produce steam, and you can run a turbine through that. And that's a power source. and not an explosion.
Mm-hmm.
If on a nuclear fission rocket, the way the ones that we built and tested and operated work, you pump liquid hydrogen, very cold, through a very hot nuclear reactor, goes out, comes in cold, goes out hot through a nozzle at over 4,000 degrees. And as I said, you could produce 4,400 megawatts, twice Hoover Dam, in something less than 8 feet in diameter, 6 feet long. So you're heating the hydrogen and exhausting it. In a chemical rocket, you react, say, hydrogen and oxygen, and that goes out the back end, water, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to fusion, if you do it electrically, that is, you accelerate particles so that they react with other particles, you can kick particles out the back end again because you've made charged particles. And in our crazy world, positive or negative particles can be directed by magnetic and electric fields. So they go out that way. If you mm-hmm. produce neutrons mostly, which you can in certain fusion reactions, they go off in all directions, and how do you get any propulsion out of that? So you want to design the systems appropriate for what it is you're trying to achieve. It can be a small nuclear reactor, fission device, put it in space. The Russians operated 36 of them to produce electricity in space. And so you can build a sideband radar. You can build a big particle beam weapon. You need power, electric power. And about the size of a wastebasket, it can produce about a megawatt, a million watts of power. Now, with fusion, aside from bombs, we haven't done much with fusion, except for those little devices I mentioned earlier where you produce neutrons and they tell you how much hydrogenous material, stuff with hydrogen in it, is around you. And if you're out where there's a good oil field, you might find there's quite a bit around you.
Mm-hmm.
So they're entirely different in the sense of what does the device look like. On the other hand, they both take advantage of the fact that nuclear energy has got a lot of energy per pound. A typical chemical reaction, like a match, for example, gives you a few electron volts. That's a unit of energy. One fission event produces 100 million electron volts of energy. That's a heck of a big difference.
Okay, so I have a question now about using this for rockets. So let's say that whatever will be NASA's successor, because it's for all the world looks like they're going out of business.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. So let's say they decide, okay, we're going to use a nuclear rocket engine, nuclear powered.
Yeah,
okay.
What we were working on in the 60s.
All right. Now
and
here's
the
question:
the idea would be to use it as an upper stage, not light it up down on the ground.
Yeah.
Use a chemical rocket. When you get up toward orbit, then you set off the fission rocket, and you can roughly triple the miles per gallon if you want to look at it that way.
Okay, but here's the question, though. The question is, a nuclear reactor cannot be shut down quickly, so how do you put the brakes on?
What, you get rid of it, or you stop pumping propellant through it. The coolant becomes the propellant, you see. So this is not something, you have to use it in the way that's appropriate for what its capabilities are.
Mm-hmm.
You don't stop and start it, because after a while you've got to keep cooling the reactor, because the products of fission, many of them are radioactive. That means they're producing energy too.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to keep cooling the darn reactor after shutdown. So it's tricky. It's a wholly different approach. When you shut the reactor down from whatever it's doing, you still have to run some coolant through it.
Okay, but what about with fusion? You don't have to do that with fusion, do you?
No. Fusion is quite different. And there, typically, if you're going to use it for propulsion, you'll have a big system. You got to use a vacuum chamber to react the different hydrogen isotopes or hydrogen and helium. You probably heard some people say one of the things that you might want to pick up on the moon or other places in the solar system is helium-3.
Yeah.
That's an isotope of helium. And if you rack that with deuterium, which is hydrogen-2, that's where you get all these charged particles which you kick out the back end. So that's an entirely different system.
Well, what I had in mind...
I should add that at one time there was Project Orion. And the idea there was to carry along a bunch of small nuclear weapons, drop them out the back end of a rocket, and set them off when they were a good enough distance away so you don't destroy the rocket, and some of the energy gets released and pushes on a pusher plate, and off you go. Bam, bam, bam,
yeah.
Bam, kind
yeah.
of thing.
Kind of a concussion.
Yeah, they never did test those because we had laws about the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. And you're wasting most of the energy.
Mm-hmm.
So the electrical approach seems much more reasonable for fusion and the gaseous approach for fission.
Well, here's what I had in mind when I asked about the breaks. Let's say that we use fusion, and we've got a nice new fusion rocket engine, and we've achieved orbit, and now we're going to flip the switch, turn on the fusion reactor, and start kicking particles out the back. And we're going to headed a long, long ways away. I don't know. We're headed a long ways. But as we get close to our destination, we're going to need to stop that propulsion. And wouldn't it...
turn it off and turn it around and turn it on.
Ah. Okay. So with fusion, you can just turn it off.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like that's the way to go, right?
It's not easy. It's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, you know, one of the reasons we can talk about the fission rockets is we found other uses for fission, the nuclear submarine, nuclear aircraft carrier, nuclear power plants. So we've got a lot of technology going. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of practice and experience with it. With fusion, we're not doing much. And you need to do it in a vacuum chamber. And unless the country says, hey, why don't we get over to Zeta Reticuli, let's say. You know, it only takes that 1G acceleration force of gravity here at the surface of the Earth. It only takes a year to get up to the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, let's use the fusion for that. And there are studies that have been published. I referenced them in my book, Flying Saucers and Science. I have a whole chapter on you can get here from there. And fusion, of course, is my technique of choice. I'm not saying there isn't anything better, because my mantra is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. A laser isn't just a better light bulb, in other words.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a chemical rocket and a fission rocket are not just one other versions of the same thing. The processes are extraordinarily different. So fusion is a great way to go if you want to really go out there, but who's going to pay the dough? You know.
Well, now, wait a minute. Could not one of these be built for, say, $1 trillion?
Oh, well, sure.
Oh, well, all we have to do is get back our money from government motors and all the bonuses paid to all those executives, get our $1 trillion, and go to Zeta Reticuli.
Well, we got to have somebody decide you want to do that. And,
you're right. We have to take a break. We'll be back right after this, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Stanton Friedman. Those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. and I think you'll be delighted that you are here. And you have my sincere sympathy for whatever kept you away from that first hour. Stanton, before we open the phone lines and allow our audience to join in our conversation this evening, there's something I want to ask you about that I know you're a nuclear physicist, and this is not nuclear physics, but I want to just get your thoughts on this. There's a report out within this last week or 2 weeks that the Chinese at the university in Shanghai have successfully used quantum entanglement to teleport photons, I believe that's correct, 100 kilometers. What do you know about that, if anything?
Quantum entanglement is not new in the sense the idea has been around. Putting it into practice, you need to go a lot farther than that. But it's crazy in the sense that you have something over here and it changes something over there without being between the two places. Action at a distance without being there. And so that's an exciting development. And remember I said earlier that I wasn't saying fusion was the ultimate, but only everybody's going to know about it who's got an advanced society.
Mm-hmm.
And quantum entanglement will be something that we'll be doing a lot of. It's kind of like when lasers came on the scene a little over 50 years ago. That was a whole new ball game for a lot of energy in a small place, and then everybody's got optical physics now and, the glass fiber optics and all this kind of stuff. It's an entirely different world from sending currents around conductors.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the same with this quantum entanglement. We haven't gotten to the point where we're using it for a lot of meaningful stuff, so to speak. But give it time. And, nobody envisioned when the laser was discovered that you'd use it for everything from surgery for people, for boring holes in bottle nipples,
mm-hmm.
for changing the surface of materials, for shooting down airplanes. You cover an enormous range of phenomena with a wholly different approach. And it's the same with quantum entanglement. It's in the esoteric world, getting into quantum physics and stuff like that, which is not just something that goes on in a classroom, in other words. So that's one of the areas where I expect there to be a lot of development. Same with nanotechnology. Get stuff real small. And one of the craziest things about the way the universe is created, when you go from a big fat atom to a small nucleus, you go way down in size, maybe 10,000 times, and you go way up in energy per particle, maybe 10 million. Now, that intuitively sounds stupid as can be, but that's the way it is.
Mm.
So with the quantum stuff, you're in a whole different realm, the entanglement, and you're going to hear a lot more about that. And once you get enough people working on it, something good's going to come out of it. You better believe it. Of course, somebody will want to use it for a weapon, too, but that's downstream.
Yeah.
We don't want that.
Okay. How about let's open up the telephone lines, and you and I will continue to talk, but we'll open the phone lines and allow people to join us as well.
Well, I need to mention something first.
Yeah. Okay.
A brand new book, AI, Aztec... incident. There's a brand new book by Scott Ramsey and his wife Suzanne. She is from Aztec, New Mexico. It's up in the northwest corner there. This is something that happened in 1948. A guy named Frank Scully wrote a book, and everybody said, oh, that's a bunch of baloney, and they're a bunch of con men, and all. It's a whole long thing. But Scott and Suzanne spent an enormous amount of money, time, effort, energy, and have gone to the archives, dug out information, talked to witnesses, and that was a genuine crash in March of 1948. Scott even went so far as to hire a guy whose expertise is in moving huge pieces of equipment across the country, where you got to worry about bridges, you know, and rivers and roads and all this kind of stuff. Because this thing in Aztec was supposedly over 90 feet in diameter. And supposedly it was taken to Los Alamos. Impossible. Well, this guy he hired, who was not a believer in flying saucers, they went over the whole route, and indeed, it was doable in 1948 under those conditions. So that's a new book. It's listed on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. Aztec Incident. And I wrote the foreword for it. And it really, it's on the website. You can order it with PayPal or whatever. But it's going to cause a lot of people a lot of anguish, but it's a darn fine piece of work. All right. I have to commend the Ramseys for spending all that time, money, effort, energy. Good people, great book. I'm proud to have written the foreword for it.
All right, let's open the telephone line, and the number, ladies and gentlemen, is 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. And, of course, if you happen to live outside of the USA or you live outside of Canada, we know that it can be expensive to make that international call. It will work, but there is an additional option for you, and that is to use the flash message option at my website, kevinsmithshow.com. All right, let's go to the telephone. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Tony from Denver.
Hello, Tony.
Kevin, I got to say thank you first and foremost. It's such an honor to get a chance to call in tonight and talk to Stanton again.
Okay.
So thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
Mr. Friedman, why does it take 40 years to go back to the moon? And my second question for you, is, do you believe it's worth $60 million to send one astronaut up to the space station?
Interesting questions. Why has it taken 40 years to go back to the moon? A failure of will, of leadership. Everybody, I worked on the space program back in the 60s. And all of us, my colleagues and I, thought for sure we'd have a base on the moon before the end of the century. And be on our way to Mars. But we haven't had goals. We needed an Admiral Rickover, and we didn't have one. That's why the nuclear navy was so successful. We had one leader who said, that's where we're going, folks. You don't want to get there, get off the ship. And it's interesting that we didn't think of using a submarine as a base for firing missiles until after we had developed the nuclear submarine. And then somebody said, hey, look what we could do. And we can hide, and nobody will know where we are, and if somebody attacks the U.S., we'll attack them, and, you know. But it was leadership. And Rickover had a policy. He'd order two of everything to get one that worked if it was necessary. So we haven't had the goal. And now, admittedly, some people will tell you that, hey, the aliens said, stay the heck off our moon. I don't subscribe to that. It's a possibility, but... And President Nixon's reason, we had a little recession. We're supposed to do Apollo 18 and 19. The rockets were built. They were not launched. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you pay the same salaries to those Navy guys, whether they're fishing astronauts out of the water or going around looking for submarines. That sounded a little fishy. Now, is it worth $60 million to get a man to the space station? Yeah, if you want to keep your place. Look, the world is changing. India and China and Japan are moving toward, I'll call them, commercial space programs. So you asked about that $60 million? It's peanuts to keep a presence up there.
Mr. Friedman, just the other day, I told some German immigrants that were interested in Roswell about you and all the work that you had done, and you were the first civilian investigator of Roswell, and why everybody talks about Roswell. And I just want to let you know that you will never be forgotten for the work that you've done exposing what actually happened at Roswell. And I want to thank you again, and thank you, Kevin, for taking my call.
Okay.
Thanks for the kind words. They love me in Roswell. If you want to go to the annual festival, it's June 29th through July 3rd. And I'll be giving 3 lectures there and signing books.
Outstanding. All right, back to the telephone and caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Jerome from Pennsylvania.
Hello, Jerome.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank you, Kevin, for asking Mr. Friedman about the nuclear engine. I called earlier one time to talk to you, and you told me to ask him directly when he was a guest, but you started out that. And Mr. Friedman, I want to say to you, I wish you success with your Hollywood endeavors.
Yeah, me too.
as far as this fusion rocket, am I correct in assuming that the only limit to that would be the amount of coolant you could carry?
Well, I wouldn't even call it coolant. I would call it propellant. Because you react the isotopes and you accelerate them out the back end. So, I would phrase it a little differently from the way you phrased it. Because you're using hydrogen and helium, you'll find that everywhere you're going. Uranium, you're going to have trouble finding everywhere you're going. So you can refuel on the way, so to speak.
The way the trains used to
pick up water as they moved across the country, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the same idea. That's much tougher with a fission rocket.
Yeah, but if you run out of the propellant, what Jerome called coolant, but you referred to as propellant, if you run out of that, you're pretty well lost in space, right?
Well, that's right, except that for most of our space trips, you only operate the rocket for a small amount of time. It coasts. And so if you've aimed it properly, you can do cosmic freeloading, as I call it. We've got the Cassini spacecraft up there at Saturn. Mm-hmm. We sent it past Venus, gave it a free kick, came past Earth, gave it another free kick, and then past Jupiter, and out we go to Saturn. So the rocket isn't running all that time.
Well, it wouldn't be if we decided. That's pretty much the slow boat to China approach, though. If you want to go to Zeta Reticuli, you need to get on with the trip.
Well, sure, but you can use it for many different profiles, mission profiles, if you will. And so, I take advantage of Einstein, get to 99.99% of the speed of light, you can go 37 light years in 6 months pilot time. That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Mr. Friedman, what would you say is the fastest that your rocket, the engine, would go?
Well, it depends on how big a rocket you want to build. You can get up to 99.99, maybe 9% of the speed of light.
That big
accelerator over there in CERN in Europe on a Swiss border.
Theoretically, do you think that you can go faster than the speed of light?
Well, you don't need to. That's why I mentioned Einstein. Whether you can or not, I don't know. Right now it doesn't look like it, but times change. Progress comes from doing things differently. Don't know how to do it.
And how does this engine differ from what I heard as being an ion engine or a plasma engine?
Oh, very different. An ion engine accelerates one atom at a time to maybe the equivalent of 40,000 volts. That's a pressure pushing the particle out. The fusion device, we're talking 10 million volts. So an ion engine is small potatoes compared to the big fusion engine.
Would you say that we already have ion engines? And
well, yeah, some have been used in space. They're good for changing orbits around the Earth. Remember, you need the power supply for all that time, and the United States has only operated one nuclear reactor in space. The Russians, as I said, have done three dozen.
And one last thing. About these Japanese nuclear power plants that are in trouble, do you feel we're being told the truth about, you know, the amount of damage and how bad it is for us?
That's an interesting question. I've talked to people in the nuclear industry, and look, there's no question that what happened in Fukushima was bad. And the reactor did what it was supposed to do. It shut off when an earthquake came, and okay, and the auxiliary power went on to cool the reactor. But then they lost the fuel for the auxiliary power from that darn tsunami. And so suddenly, two major events at the same time. I don't know about you, but when I saw the movie news broadcast of that tsunami and saw houses and boats and cars and people and everything being dragged along by the water, I was incredulous. What a horrible mess. Now, the kicker is, we don't know what's happening to that stuff in the ocean. California's getting some of that stuff. Canada's getting some of that stuff. And, you know, all kinds of junk is washing up on the coast. Do we have the full story? Probably not. But, you know, radioactivity is all around us anyway. And the nice thing about radioactivity is that you can measure it. You can detect it. You know it's there. So it's not like a poison gas that you can't smell or something, you know, where suddenly you realize you've had too much. With the radiation, you can measure the radioactivity present. So we probably aren't getting the whole story because we don't know what the eventual whole story will be. And one thing I will say, I just read today, that the rate at which the stuff has been coming across the ocean, for whatever reason, it's been getting to the west coast of North America earlier, a month earlier than had been expected. And the quicker it gets here, the more radioactive it is. So that's not good news. But on the other hand, most of us aren't going to go swimming in that chunk of the ocean where all this radioactive junk is.
No, it is very disheartening. I want to thank you for being a guest. And, Kevin, thank you for taking my call.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Could it be that the stuff is getting to our West Coast quicker because it's a higher concentration piling in behind it?
Don't know, and it depends on all kinds of currents and flowing out there and how rapidly the stuff breaks up. I saw a hunk of a bicycle that made it all the way across.
Was it glowing in the dark?
No, of course it wasn't.
Okay, to the telephone. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, Kevin, this is Ryan in Washington.
Hello, Ryan.
Yes, are you guys aware of the article that was published today about John Alexander?
I'm not.
I did see it, yes.
Well, for those who might not know, John Alexander, who I have a lot of respect for, he gets a bad rap, but he's not a debunker. He believes UFOs are real. I happen to respect the man, but anyways, the article is on the Huffington Post. It was on the front page, and John Alexander has sent formal letters to both Leon Panetta, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and one other high-ranking individual, I can't remember, asking them to grant immunity to military UFO witnesses. And I find this pretty interesting because he is connected. He has a lot of connections. Now, he has I know that a lot of people give him a bad rap and discredit him on the cover-up issue, but I think we need him on our side. I think we need him because he's not a debunker, but I know that a lot of people disagree with him about the whether or not the government's hiding anything, which is debatable, and I know Stan's opinion because I've heard him debate him, but I just wanted to know if you guys had heard about that. Stan, do you have any comments?
Well, I heard about it, and, you know, I found it interesting that he would write those letters. On the other hand, in the article it states he believes disclosure has already occurred, and he assumes that because he and his buddies couldn't find anybody in Washington who would tell them where the center of UFO cover-up is, so to speak, that there must not be one. But he wouldn't answer the question when I asked him it. We debated at a conference in Phoenix, in February, this past year, last year, not this year. He wouldn't answer the question, John, how many times did you tell people who didn't have a need to know or an appropriate clearance for top secret code word information? He never answered that question. I don't know why anybody would have told him anything. It's just like I had somebody telling me that, it was about Kennedy and Donald Menzel on the whole MJ-12 business. Well, this guy wrote a book with Menzel, and surely he would have told him about Roswell if it had really happened and so forth. And security depends on two things, a need to know and an appropriate clearance. And without both of them, you don't get access.
Mm-hmm.
I never told my wife anything that was classified. You don't tell your friends anything that's classified. And so I don't understand why John, who should know better, thinks that somebody would have told him where all this hot stuff was. It'll be interesting.
Let me make one more comment, and then I'll get off the line.
Okay.
Because I don't want to hold up the line too much, and I respect you, Stan. I feel like I'm talking to somebody that's you're well respected by the way. But the other comment is, there's a lot of UFO news that's going on today. Are you still there?
No, we left.
There's a lot of news that's still going on today. A lot of recent UFO news. In fact, today there was an apparent mid-air collision over Denver, where the pilot and the crew witnessed an object that flew past them, almost caused a collision, that did not register on radar. It's on the internet, you can read the news on that. And the FAA now is going to investigate it, but it was at a high altitude, moving at a high speed, that almost collided with an airplane over Denver.
So, okay, it's about 8,000 feet, and we have to step away for a break. Ryan, thank you so much for the call, and we'll be back, folks, right after this.
Virginia. And you are smart because you are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Kevin Smith Show. And by the way, while I've got your attention, be sure you click that link on my website that says Alternative Universe Eye Conference. Get your ticket. Don't let time run out on you. You'll be kicking yourself if you miss this. All right? It's $10. It's worth at least $100, but it's $10. Okay? That's your only expense for having this conference come right into your home or office or wherever you watch things on your computer. All right, let's go back to my guest, Stanton Friedman, and let me remind everyone of the telephone number. It is 623-444-5889. And Stanton, are you still with us?
I think so.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Oh, this is John in Arizona.
Hello, John.
Your old stomping grounds.
Yeah.
And you're probably glad you're not here, since it was 106 today.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. I had enough of that and decided it was time to move out of the northern suburbs of hell.
And you're much smarter men than I am, I guess, since I'm still here and have been here for many years.
Yeah. What's your question or comment for Stanton?
Yeah, I do. It seems like I got in on the last 15 minutes the last time you were on the show. But I don't think I have any title to that, but I managed to get lucky again this time. I have a question. We're talking about Fukushima and the radiation that's heading this direction. What do you know about the radiation for all of the above-ground nuclear explosions that happened after the World War II and before the ban on it between the U.S. and Russia? Somewhere upwards of 500 above-ground nuclear explosions. What happened to all that radiation?
It dissipates. There are half-lives involved. Actually, we Earthlings, I'm presuming you're an Earthling as I am, have exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons. 2,000. Now, you're right, not all of them were above ground, but the radioactivity was measurable at the time. It decays rapidly. So in a few years, there's not much left. That doesn't mean that you can't find any, but and frankly, there were times when you could buy milk that was radioactive in Rochester, New York, from test runs out in the West Coast, near the West Coast.
Yeah? Wonderful.
Yeah, man is pretty stupid. He spreads bad stuff around all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was kind of like those old X-ray machines that you could stick your feet in to see if your shoes fit right, but that was before they realized that too many X-rays was not good for you.
Well, especially the other organs that are on the way between the X-ray and the feet.
Right, yeah, it wasn't shielded very well at all.
That's right.
Well, I had heard that, there are a lot of things that emit radiation, including granite. So,
well, sure. We all are exposed to radiation. Some of us have a lot of radon in our basements. Some of the houses are made out of stuff. And an interesting thing happened in Taiwan. Two buildings were built, very similar. One, the steel, happened to have had radioactive cobalt 60 dumped in when they were doing the mix. Not intentionally, of course. And then they realized years later, somebody discovered it, holy cow, we've been irradiated here. Well, they did a lot of health records on the people who lived in these two buildings, which were otherwise basically identical. And they found that the people in the building that had the radioactive materials had better health. And there is that's not surprising. There's a process called radiation hormesis, H-O-R-M-E-S-I-S. It applies to many things, in which a small amount does you good and a big amount does you bad. Think of aspirin. You know, two aspirin will take care of your headache. 30 might kill you. So
right.
With radiation, it turns out that apparently the kicker here is that the immune system, we have a system that's able to handle a certain amount of radiation. Bacteria won't multiply as well, believe it or not, when there's a lower radiation level than when there's a higher level. Which sounds a little weird to some people, but that's the way it is. Measurements.
So, the next question is...
Not all radioactivity is bad, is what I'm saying.
Do we, who have been exposed, you know, to some of us here in southern Arizona, and let's face it, Nevada isn't all that far away.
No.
Do we build a tolerance for a higher level over a period of time, or does it kill us off?
Well, one of the crazy things about radiation and people is that nobody's ever been able to predict who's going to react badly to it. The people who treat tumors, you know, with radioactive materials, some people get sick as a dog, and other people shake off the same dose, doesn't bother them at all. So we don't know.
Kind of like the Black Plague in Europe. You know, a lot of people died, but a lot of them were survived.
Yeah, and the very important part of the radiation question is the dose rate as opposed to the total dose that you get. In other words,
right, that
after you've been exposed to an atom bomb, obviously you get an awful lot of radiation at once. The same amount spread over a long period of time, we can shake off, so to speak. Our system can handle it. And so it's very hard to make any hard and fast rules. Yeah, it's not a good idea to get too much radiation. But if you sleep in the same bed with somebody for a year, you get a measurable dose of radiation from them and them from you. So, you know, the fact you can measure it doesn't mean it's going to clobber you. It's complicated.
Okay, John.
Well, that was pretty much all I had, Kevin.
All right. Thank you for the call.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye. I have a flash message from Kenzie in Australia. And she says, Mr. Friedman, with the appropriate funding, how long would it take for us to be able to fly in space with a nuclear rocket?
With just a fission rocket and around Earth, we could be doing that in 3 years, no sweat, because we've got the technology. It's sitting in a warehouse, so to speak. It's on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
You better have some place to go. You know, maybe you want to set up a colony on the moon or Earth orbit, lunar orbit, or go to Mars. How much money you want to spend will be the determining factor. To give you an example, when I was working on nuclear airplanes way back in 1958, a long time ago, at General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department, we spent $100 million that year. We employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. And $100 million was a lot of money in 1958.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is you can't say, well, I got $10,000 to spend or $10 million. Won't do the job.
Mm-hmm. Well, $100 million would be about $1 billion today, right?
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. Oh, wow. You know, we toss billions around and lose billions like it's water drops. All right, let's go to the telephone and caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Well, hello. This is Gary in Nebraska.
Hello, Gary.
And I want to thank you, Kevin, for inviting Stanton to be on the program, and thank you, Stanton, for being on the program.
You're welcome.
You know, I fear for the future of our country's space exploration, and I don't know if it's unfounded or not. So I wonder, do you have any insights, Stanton, on what it may be for, in the near or long term?
Well, if we get some leadership, that's what we need. You know, give Wernher von Braun credit. He provided some leadership. Admiral Rickover provided leadership. We need people like that. And we could be back flying, you know, in just a few years. If we still just piddle along, well, let's try a little of this and a little of that, and maybe we'll let the Japanese or the Chinese or the Indians carry us aloft. Everything is goal setting and then going forward. I mean, President Kennedy's decision was a perfect example. He said by the end of the decade, so that gave him almost 10 years, almost, not quite, 10 years. And that meant all the subsidiary goals, like orbital rendezvous and stuff like that, could be accomplished without having to go back to budget again, you know, oh, we need more money to do this or that. It was all part of the bigger picture. And remember, we had courage then. Three guys died on the pad, remember, with the fire?
Yeah.
We didn't say, oh, my goodness, we can't do any more of that. Stop.
Yeah.
We said, this is where we're going, and there are prices to pay, and nobody is for killing astronauts, for goodness sakes, but it goes with the territory, so to speak. And so ask any test pilot, and they know that some of them are going to go in. The guys who fly on aircraft carriers and land at night in the middle of the ocean with no lighting and with the ship moving up and down, boy, those guys know that somebody's going to not make it. But it's part of the picture. 30,000 people died in automobile accidents in the United States last year. That doesn't mean we're going to stop, you know, driving automobiles. We do what we can to make it work better. So it's a question of courage and direction and recognizing that how much benefit we've had from space. You know, it's not just weather satellites and stuff like that and GPS systems. Nobody envisioned GPS when we first went into space. An awful lot of people are helped by it now. So we need courage and vision. These are not easy things to find in our leadership today.
So would you suggest perhaps I don't need to feel a sense of hopelessness about this?
No, you don't. I'm an optimist, and I'm 77, so I'm still optimistic, yes.
All right. Well, thank you, Stan. Have a pleasant evening.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. I did a show where I had a question for NASA. You know, they said, we're not going back to the moon. And, that manned mission to Mars, forget that. We're not going to do that. And most of our planetary exploration, forget that. We're not going to do that. And then within about a week, you had the administrator of NASA saying, oh, we've got this new rocket system that we're building that's going to carry us farther and faster than ever before. And my question was, where the hell to?
Well, you see what I mean about needing leadership to set goals.
Yeah.
And there's been a great lack of that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that just because I live in Canada. I'm a dual citizen. My right to complain about both governments.
All right, to the telephone and caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. This is Phil from Philadelphia.
Well, hello, Phil. Phil,
how are you doing? Hi, Stanton. How are you?
Okay.
Hi.
Phil, listen, we're almost to break, so we will get interrupted, but we'll put you on hold when that happens, and we'll come right back to you. So go ahead.
Very good. Google Earth takes great pictures of even my van in the driveway. Why can't we get some really good shots of the lunar buggy and the LEM lander on the moon that would really convince me that we've been there?
Well, remember that the pictures that you take of your van, and they can read the license plates too with the NRO stuff from space. Remember, they're up a couple hundred miles. We don't have that situation with regard to the moon. We don't have anything running around there up a couple hundred miles with that, with the same capability that you're talking about. So I've seen, you know, that whole discussion, did we go to the moon or not? There's an awful lot of data out there, and I hate to recommend it, but bad astronomy.
Okay. We'll get the recommendations when we come back. We have to step away for the break. Hang in there, Phil. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, talk radio like nowhere else on earth, and our guest this evening is Stanton Friedman, and on the line with us from Philadelphia is Phil. Phil, is your city named after you?
No, it's not, Kevin.
No, okay. All right. Just thought I would check. All right, now you had asked, why can't we get a clear shot of these landing sites on the moon when we can get, with Google Earth, a clear shot of your car in the driveway? And Stanton, you had started to answer.
Well, yeah. One of them is that the good systems are heavy for checking on what's in your driveway, the NRO systems and those other ones. And we can't put that much payload up going around the moon. Cheaply, anyway. But there are plenty of answers to the questions that have been raised about going to the moon. And I've seen a couple pictures which point to the locations of several of the things we put up there. We also get back, of course, the seismometry information. We put that device up there, and it took a landing to do it. And, you know, there's the data on the rocks that have come back from the moon clearly indicates that it's from up there, not from down here.
Yeah, but why can't we get better pictures? Stanton, let me throw this out. Phil, I'm going to join your side of the question here for just a moment. I'm going to play the devil's advocate. Stanton, they showed us these pictures of the various Apollo landing sites.
Yes.
But you can go on NASA's website and you look at those pictures, and it will tell you what resolution the pictures are shot at. Now, on their website, you can also go look at the T-Y-C-H-E, I think it's pronounced Tychy or Tychy,
yeah.
Crater.
Crater, yeah.
And it's shot with three times less resolution, and you can see pebbles clearly, crystal clear, on the ground. What's up with that?
Where were the pictures taken from? How far away?
They were both taken from...
Clementine?
No, this is the exact same camera, the lunar orbiter that's up there now. Exact same camera that shot the Apollo landing sites. And you have the T-Y-C-H-E crater shot by that same camera, and you can clearly see pebbles on the ground at three times less resolution. And I have said about the Apollo pictures, I'm not calling into question whether we went, but I have said those are not the clearest pictures they have. That's the clearest pictures they will let you see.
Well, I was going to add that a lot of the Clementine pictures haven't been released.
Yeah, no, this is not the Clementine mission.
No, but I mean, it's the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
That the fact that the pictures exist doesn't mean you're going to get them.
Well, that's the point. And my point is there's something about those landing sites they don't want you to see.
Well, it may be that they don't want you to see how good the cameras are.
Yeah, but you can with that picture of the how do you pronounce that? Tyche? Tyche?
Tycho.
No,
T Y C H scientist.
Yeah, T Y C H E, I believe, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah.
But there was an O at the end, but it doesn't matter.
Well, anyway, with that bunch of pictures at three times less resolution than what they say the Apollos are shot at, I can see pebbles clearly. I mean, you can almost see grains of sand. And so,
I plead ignorance, Kevin. I can't answer your question in detail.
Yeah, it's a mystery. Phil, have you seen the pictures of that crater that I'm talking about?
Yes, that. And if I just add one thing, Kevin.
Uh-huh. Yeah, go ahead.
The reason I say it is it would put all the naysayers, I'm all for being on the moon. I hope that we went. I've seen it. It was a great asset. I'm science-based, etc. All it would take to shut up myself and all the little naysayer groundswell is 15-second shot of one of the doom buggies they have up there, or the six landers, or the 1,200 lineal miles they put on four-wheel driving at 40 miles up with zero to no atmosphere. Should be crystal clear that you could read the serial number off the battery pack, I would think, on the lander.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you got to be in the right orbit to do that.
Well, they could do it, and you know, they're taking these crystal clear shots. Here's another thing, Stanton. When you go to the Tycho or Tychy or whatever it is crater, when you go to those pictures, you click the little button at the bottom of their screen, and you can enlarge it six times.
Wow.
And it does not lose clarity as you enlarge it. And you can almost see individual grains of sand. You go to the Apollos, you can enlarge it twice. And so something's up. They're hiding something, but that's not new for NASA.
No, it isn't.
Phil, thanks for the call.
You're welcome. Thanks, Stanton. You're the best. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
My thoughts on the moon thing is that I think we went. I think some of the video we've seen is fake. I think some of the pictures we've seen are fake. They were done in studios. And I think the reason is there were things on the moon they did not want us to see. And so they pre-recorded and they pre-shot some of the still shots. And, and then the stuff that is actually from the moon, well, it's full of airbrush. There's airbrush marks everywhere. And from the stuff that's actually from the moon.
I'm not going to argue with you about that. And like I say, I like my first explanation for why we didn't go back. Somebody said, stay the heck off our moon.
You know, that statement that's why we didn't go back is from Maurice Chatelain's book, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I would say, being the director of communications during all those missions, if anybody knows, he knows. So,
it's one of the many mysteries we have.
It is, indeed, one of the many, many mysteries we have. Okay, now, I want to go back to Kinsey's question. Is it Kinsey? Kinsey, yeah, from Australia, about if we had appropriate funding, how long would it take? And you said in 3 years. Okay, if we had this nuclear-powered rocket operational 3 years from now, would we use that to go to Mars, or is that too close to be using that?
No, for the fission rocket, like the Phoebus that operated at 4,400 megawatts, no, Mars is one of the goals was to make it an upper stage to get you to Mars.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. How long would it take us to get to Mars that way?
Maybe a month.
All right.
You're trying to minimize the weight of the rocket because it costs you to put stuff up.
Well, and the fuel for the nuclear power would be a fraction, a micro fraction of the weight of all of the liquid fuel, the chemical fuel.
Oh, yeah, but remember, you've got to put this up on a chemical rocket to begin with.
Yeah. Hey, we've just run out of time. Stanton, stay on the phone with me for just a moment. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm forced to say, my friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.